Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, March 17th, 2022. The Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin's positive test for COVID changing up the traditional St. Patrick's Day celebrations in Washington, D.C. His meeting with President Biden in the Oval Office goes virtual, and the Capitol Hill luncheon skipped altogether. Still, the Irish and U.S. leaders reaffirming today their country's strong ties. President Biden and the Prime Minister Martin also condemning what they call Russia's inhumane and barbaric war against Ukraine. At the State Department, Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying he, like President Biden, believes that Russia is committing war crimes in Ukraine, and a formal process to investigate is underway. U.S. House passing a bill that ends regular trade privileges between the U.S. and Russia, something called Normal Trade Relations, or NTR. Also today, the IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig telling the House Ways and Means Committee that the huge backlog of unprocessed tax returns and correspondence will be caught up by the end of this year. We'll talk about that with Congressman Tom Reed, Republican from New York, a member of that committee. And we start with the Irish Prime Minister, Michael Martin, in Washington, D.C. for St. Patrick's Day. The celebrations were to include meeting President Joe Biden at the White House, then a luncheon on Capitol Hill. But as Associated Press writes, the visiting leader's positive test for COVID-19 scrambled plans. Instead, the White House Oval Office meeting was virtual. He was across the street at the Blair House. President Biden seated next to a TV monitor with a crystal bowl of shamrocks on the coffee table beside him. President and the Prime Minister also talking about the Russian war in Ukraine and the Good Friday peace accords. First, President Biden.
Well, Tishika, I'm really deeply sorry for the inconvenience we have to meet virtually again this year, although I did at a little distance for 7.5 minutes get to see you yesterday, and your beautiful wife, especially after you flying all the way here to Washington and with a lot going on up in the hill and the rest. Just as we did last year, the tradition, this beautiful bowl, the tradition of these beautiful shamrocks I have here with me. And we're meeting in a moment when demands on unity in the world are really accelerating. We have to be united, and we certainly are. Putin's brutality and what he's doing and his troops are doing in Ukraine is just inhumane. As you know, your predecessor and you occasionally kid me, but are always quoting Irish poets. But Yeats had a great line on Easter Sunday, 1990. He said, "All's changed utterly. A terrible beauty has been born." He was talking about his Ireland and what was going to come, which turned out to be better than worse. But all has changed. I think that your leadership on the global stage has really been noticeable and impressive. You're now a member of a member of the Security Council. Your leadership on the global stage within the EU as well, and your condemnation of Putin's aggression and support of the sanctions, and it's costing Ireland. It's costing Ireland. But as usual, you're basing it on principle and moral standing of the country, and. But I also want to emphasize this administration's unequivocal support for the Good Friday Accords, for the Good Friday Agreement. I've made that clear, as you probably heard, to the Prime Minister and others. I think it's too much blood, sweat, and tears have been shed to get that done, and this is no time to change it.
President Biden in the White House Oval Office speaking to the Irish Prime Minister, who was on a TV monitor. The Good Friday Accords or agreement was signed in 1998. It helped end violence that had been going on for about three decades in Northern Ireland over whether that area should become part of Ireland or stay part of the United Kingdom. It's a time euphemistically known as the Troubles. After President Biden spoke, the Irish Prime Minister, or Taoiseach, Michael Martin, made some remarks, again, joining virtually.
Last year, we met virtually across the Atlantic. This year, we're meeting virtually across the road, so we're getting closer. But I'm feeling good, and I think that reminds us of the importance of vaccines. Because vaccines prevent severe illness. And that reminds us that central message we give to people: get vaccinated if you're not vaccinated. But of course, it is unfortunate, but it's no more than that. And I share with you our horror at the barbaric attack on the civilians of Ukraine. And I want to take this opportunity to genuinely salute your leadership. It's firm, it's determined, it's strong, it's measured in the teeth of this crisis, and particularly your capacity to marshal like-minded democracies, the US, the European Union, the United Kingdom, other Canada and other like-minded democracies are coming together to respond in an unprecedented way to this barbaric attack on the women and children of Ukraine. Our thoughts are with them, and on the young people who are dying because of this unjustifiable and immoral war on a people by the regime of Vladimir Putin. And I think it's extremely important that we keep this unity of purpose over the coming while. And Ireland stands ready to do everything we possibly can on the humanitarian front and in supporting the broadest and widest sanctions possible to keep the pressure on and to get this war ended, because there's simply too much suffering. And it's heartrending to see the appalling loss of life and also the terrible trauma on the children of Ukraine and their mothers as they flee this war zone. And we're very seized by this in Ireland, and the response has been great to behold in terms of the people of Ireland who want to do everything they possibly can here. May I also just thank you again in respect of the Good Friday Agreement, your steadfast support and that of Speaker Pelosi and our friends on the Hill in giving a very clear message in respect of how important the Good Friday Agreement is in respect of stability and peace on the island of Ireland. And over the last number of days, as I've been here, we've also witnessed once again that two-way, very robust economic relationship between the United States and Ireland. It's a two-way relationship. Met Irish companies yesterday who are creating 100,000 jobs in the US now. And that's because of that partnership between Ireland, Europe, and the US.
That's the Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin meeting online with President Biden, who was in the Oval Office on this St. Patrick's Day. Martin learned he had tested positive for COVID-19 Wednesday night while attending the Ireland Fund's annual gala at the National Building Museum in Washington. He was sitting beside House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and also speaking at that event, not far away, President Biden. But the White House says the president not considered a close contact of Martin, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. An update today from the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The president has had a couple of close calls over the last couple of days, the same gentleman and the Irish Prime Minister last night. Has he been tested today? What was the result of that testing? Can we know?
He was not tested today. He was tested last Sunday. Neither of these individuals were considered close contacts. The doctors at the CDC determine what close contacts look like, and that a close contact is someone who is less than 6 feet away from an infected person for a cumulative total of 15 minutes or more over a 24-hour period. That is how they define it. And of course, our doctors look closely at that as well. And neither of these two individuals did he spend that amount of time with. And so his weekly testing cadence remains as it has been. It has not changed.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki getting reporters' questions in the White House briefing room. New York Times writes that the Irish Prime Minister's test result came amid a burst of infections among public officials in Washington in recent days. At least 9 Democratic members of Congress tested positive this week after party retreat and late-night voting last week. Douglas Emhoff, husband of Vice President Kamala Harris, also tested positive this week, as did former President Barack Obama. Also today, President Biden announcing his White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Jeff Zients, will be leaving his job next month and will be replaced by Ashish Jha, an epidemiologist and the dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. As mentioned, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did sit next to the Irish Prime Minister at yesterday's event. And during Pelosi's briefing with reporters on Capitol Hill, she explained what happened. She also gave a little history of the traditional Friends of Ireland luncheon held in the U.S. Capitol building.
Last night I had the privilege of sitting with the Taoiseach at a dinner, at the Friends of Ireland dinner, at which I was had the honor of giving him an award, an international leadership award, on behalf of the Friends of Ireland and on behalf of our members of Congress. Right before I was supposed to give him the award, the Taoiseach left the table, and then I was told that the ambassador would be accepting the award on his behalf and giving his speech. So we're very, very sad that on St. Patrick's Day, the Taoiseach has this diagnosis, and also the luncheon that we would be having today, we won't be able to have the benefit of the honor of his presence. Just so you know, this is a lunch that was started by Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan when Tip was Speaker and Reagan was President. The first luncheon, this luncheon, didn't have the Taoiseach. It was just the Speaker and the President. That's what it'll be today, the Speaker and the President. We would rather, of course, have the Taoiseach. And subsequently, the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister of Ireland, was invited. The first luncheon, Tip O'Neill invited 16 members, 12 from Massachusetts. And it's grown since then. We'd have, perhaps you'll cover what we say in that meeting, but we'll have a wonderful turnout of members. I don't have Irish grandparents, but I do have Irish grandchildren, and I always brag about them, as you can imagine. I just wanted to say that in consultation with the Office of the Attending Physician, I will continue regular testing following CDC guidelines. Our Friends of Ireland lunch will proceed today without the participation of the Taoiseach, in case those of you in green had any concerns about that. Any questions?
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi meeting with reporters at her weekly briefing on Capitol Hill. And a few hours later, that Friends of Ireland luncheon did take place. The Irish ambassador to the United States, Dan Mulhall, standing in for the Prime Minister. Speaker Pelosi making some remarks, and so did President Biden. We have that archive at cspan.org. And near the end, House Speaker Pelosi with a toast, and then there was one offered as well by President Joe Biden.
I wanted all of us to lift our glass to toast the president on this St. Patrick's Day. Mr. President, this is a toast that I learned from my grandchildren. I've said it to our colleagues here before. And it goes like this. It's an Irish toast. Sing as if no one can hear you. Dance as if no one can see you. Love as if you've never loved before. And live as if heaven is on earth. So when I said to them, is that a toast that is a tradition in the Keneally family? They say, no, that's a sign that is in the Shannon Airport. To the president.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Well, my grandmother had one. She said, may those who love us, and those who don't, may they turn their ankles so we know they're coming by their limp.
President Biden and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at today's luncheon. It also featured some Irish dancer entertainment. U.S. Census Bureau survey in 2019 finding about 32 million Americans identify as being Irish, just under 10% of the population. And now on Washington Today to Russia's war on Ukraine. Reports continue to come out of Ukraine about Russian missile and artillery attacks on civilian targets. 21 people killed by Russian artillery that destroyed a school and a community center in Marifa near the northeast city of Kharkiv. And attempts to pull survivors from the rubble of a destroyed theater in Mariupol in the south are being hindered by the breakdown of social services in the city and dangers of further Russian attacks, according to local officials. Russian forces have also been accused of using cluster munitions and vacuum bombs in the war, which would violate international law if used indiscriminately against civilians. President Biden yesterday, for the first time, calling Russian President Vladimir Putin a war criminal. And today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he agrees with that assessment.
With every day that passes, the number of civilians, including children, killed and wounded, continues to climb. Russia continues to attack civilian sites, including this week alone, a hospital, three schools, a boarding school for visually impaired kids in the Luhansk region of Ukraine. Yesterday, Russian forces bombed a theater in Mariupol where hundreds of people had been taking shelter. The word children had been written in Russian in giant white letters on the pavement outside the building so that you could know from the air that there were children inside. Russian forces also opened fire on 10 civilians who were waiting in line for bread. These incidents join a long list of attacks on civilian, not military locations across Ukraine, including apartment buildings, public squares, and last week, a maternity hospital in Mariupol. I doubt that any of us who saw those images will ever forget them. We've seen Russia use similar tactics before, in Grozny, in Aleppo. They stepped up their bombardment with the goal of breaking the will of the people. Yesterday, President Biden said that, in his opinion, war crimes have been committed in Ukraine. Personally, I agree. Intentionally targeting civilians is a war crime. After all the destruction of the past 3 weeks, I find it difficult to conclude that the Russians are doing otherwise.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the State Department. He says U.S. officials are evaluating and documenting potential war crimes by Russia. The U.S. also working with dozens of countries to investigate possible war crimes under resolution passed by the United Nations Human Rights Council, and the International Criminal Court also doing its own investigation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov this morning reacting to President Biden's use of the term war criminal yesterday, telling the Russian state news agency TASS that that is unacceptable and unforgivable rhetoric on the part of the head of a state whose bombs have killed hundreds of thousands of people around the world. Secretary Blinken also confirming today that another U.S. citizen has been killed in a Russian attack in the Ukrainian city of Cherniv. At least two U.S. citizens now confirmed killed during the war. Blinken also saying Russian likely to kidnap local officials and replace them with puppets. He said there's a strong sense that Russia is setting the stage to use chemical weapons. And he was also asked about diplomatic efforts. He says he has not seen any meaningful advances by Russia to end the war through diplomacy. As part of the sanctions against Russia by the United States and other Western countries, President Biden calling for an end to NTR, normal trade relations status with Russia and Belarus, which supports the war in Ukraine. U.S. House passing a bill today to do just that. Starting the debate on the House floor, the leaders of the Ways and Means Committee, Democratic Chairman Richard Neal of Massachusetts, then you're going to hear the ranking Republican Kevin Brady of Texas.
Madam Speaker, yesterday morning, the Congress heard directly from Ukrainian President Zelensky. He showed us the absolute horrors that Russia is inflicting on the Ukrainian people in full view of the world. And he pleaded for us to do more. With the legislation that stands before us at this hour, we intend to answer his call. Ranking Member Brady and I have been united in our desire to end permanent normal trade relations with Russia. And I must say that Mr. Brady has been very consistent as we've discussed this legislation. With the House passage of H.R. 7108 today, we will take that impactful step and place even greater economic pressure on Putin and his brutal regime. We must do everything in our power to hold Russia accountable for the atrocities it is committing hourly in the nation of Ukraine. This is an unprovoked horror that the world is seeing. Our partners and allies are joining with us in this effort, taking similar steps to further isolate Putin and his regime from the rest of the civilized world. I urge every single one of our colleagues today to support the Ukrainian people, punish Russia for its ruthless aggression, and vote to advance this measure. I reserve the balance of my time.
The gentleman reserves. The gentleman from Texas is recognized.
Yes, Madam Speaker, I yield myself as much time as I may consume.
The gentleman is recognized.
Madam Speaker, yesterday President Zelensky made a passionate plea to the United States and to all free nations to stand with the brave people of Ukraine against Putin's deadly ambitions and heartbreaking genocide. After showing gut-wrenching footage of Ukrainian cities torn apart by missiles and machine guns, he said, "To be the leader of the world means to be the leader of peace." Today, Madam Speaker, we have the opportunity to lead, and I thank Chairman Neal for his great leadership and work on this bipartisan provision. After bipartisan public pressure from lawmakers in Congress in both parties, President Biden announced his support for suspending Russia's special trade status. We are taking that action with today's bill. I was proud to have helped lead this bipartisan effort of the House Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees. Both parties in Congress came together quickly, working in good faith on a bipartisan bicameral agreement to immediately ban purchases of Russian energy and suspend our trading relationship with Russia and Belarus. We don't take these steps lightly, but Russia's aggression requires this approach. Russia will no longer enjoy the same special trade status with America as the country it is invading. So it will no longer be able to sell made-in-Russia products in the United States at lower tariffs. Combined with the energy import ban Congress passed last week, which targets 60% of what Russia sells us, this provision targets the remaining 40%, hurting Russia's economy and cutting off funding for its war effort. Said another way, American dollars will no longer fund Russia's war machine.
Congressman Kevin Brady, ranking Republican on the Ways and Means Committee. Before that, you heard the chair, Richard Neal, part of the House floor debate. Before they passed this bill, the vote was 424-8. The 8 no votes coming from Republicans. Biggs of Arizona, Bishop of North Carolina, Boebert of Colorado, Gates of Florida, Green of Georgia, Grothman of Wisconsin, Massey from Kentucky, and Roy from Texas. Bill now heads to the Senate. The Hill writes that trade and sanctions experts say the bill would have limited direct impact on the Russian economy. The U.S. imports very little from Russia other than energy products, vodka, and seafood, all of which have already been banned by President Biden. And dozens of American businesses have already begun to pull out of Russia. Even so, the measure, in concert with similar bans in Europe, would strike another symbolic blow against Russia and push it further outside the global economy. That from thehill.com. Defense Minister of NATO member Slovakia says his country is willing to provide its Soviet-era S-300 long-range air defense missile systems to Ukraine, which Ukraine has asked for, but only if a proper replacement is provided, so Slovakia does not have a gap in its own defense capabilities. But U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin not prepared today to make that commitment. The two of them held a joint news conference in Bratislava, the capital city of Slovakia.
Minister Naja, could you, I mean, ask you directly about S-300s. Is your country willing to provide those to Ukraine, and only if you are able to receive some sort of replacement system that would not degrade your air defenses? Is that something that is continuing to be under discussion with the United States? And may I ask also a question of Secretary Austin? Mr. Secretary, you mentioned that you would be discussing the subject with other allies and partners. Are there alternatives in this area? In other words, the problem being the Russians have increasingly used long-range missiles to attack population centers in Ukraine, as you've mentioned. Are there alternatives to the S-300 to help Ukraine in that long-range air defense arena? That would be my question. Thank you.
You're right, Bob. The systems that are being used to by the Russians to engage Ukrainian forces currently they're using a lot of rockets and missiles and artillery, and so there are a number of things that can be used to counter that. We've seen that drones have been very effective. We've also seen having the ability to conduct counterfire with rockets and artillery is also very effective. And so I think increasingly we'll see the Ukrainian forces turn to those methods to counter that. The rockets that you, or there were actually cruise missiles that that you mentioned that were fired from aerial platforms, I think, that those were fired from actually inside of Russia. So a no-fly zone would not have prevented that that activity. So.
If I may, Mr. Burns, thank you for your question. Well, we've been in discussion with the United States, with Ukraine, and also with other allies on possibility to deploy or to send or to give S-300 system to Ukrainians. And we are willing to do so. We're willing to do so immediately when we have a proper replacement. The only strategic air defense system that we have in Slovakia is S-300 system. So what would happen immediately when we decide to give it to Ukrainians is that we actually create a gap, a security gap in NATO. So, you know, and I'm the defense minister of Slovakia. My first responsibility is to take on, to do all, everything I am capable of to guarantee defense and security of our people and our territory. So, yes, we've been in discussion. We are in discussion. There are no further comments to make as of now. But yes, should there be a situation that we have a proper replacement or that we have a capability guaranteed for a certain period of time, then we would be willing to discuss the future of S-300 system.
The Slovakian Defense Minister Jaroslav Naja and the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, a joint news conference in Bratislava, Slovakia today, as Lloyd Austin is making a trip to several Eastern European countries. The legislative leaders of the three Baltic countries, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, all members of NATO, testifying today before the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe. It's also called the Helsinki Commission. It's a U.S. government commission, and its members come from the U.S. House, U.S. Senate, and the executive branch. One of the witnesses, the chair of the Lithuanian Foreign Affairs Committee, Laima Andrikienė, telling the commission that she believes if Russian President Vladimir Putin gets away with invading Ukraine, he'll be coming after NATO countries next.
This man is unpredictable. Before the 24th of February, even seeing those, you know, Russia's buildup along Ukrainian border and in Ukraine, not many people in the world believed that Putin will give an order for a massive military aggression against Ukraine. And I have to say that our intelligence also, that was, you know, miscalculated. There were, you know, informations that Russian army will be in Kiev in 48 hours since the beginning of the military attack. This does not happen. And be miscalculated the readiness of Ukrainians to defend their country and the spirit in the country. Be also miscalculated the strengths of the Russian army. And be miscalculated the position of the European Union on this. Not many politicians and political leaders expected this dramatic change of the position of Germany and some other countries. And that changed the situation dramatically. What I understand that Putin is targeting not only Ukraine, is targeting our security architecture in Europe. If Putin remains in power after this war, we will not have peace. Lithuania is, we have to support Ukraine until the very end, whatever Putin says, until the victory of Ukraine. If we fail in Ukraine, it will be only a matter of time until Putin continues his aggression against us, against NATO allies, against Georgia and Moldova. So we are supporting, Lithuania is supporting Ukraine in many different areas, and we will continue to do this. And as you possibly know, Lithuania was the first one to provide lethal munition to Ukraine and many other things.
Laima Andre Kieny is the chair of the Lithuanian Foreign Affairs Committee, one of the witnesses today to the Helsinki Commission, a U.S. government commission. Kosovo's president sending a letter to President Biden asking President Biden to help her country become a NATO member. She writes, Kosovo's membership in NATO has become an imperative, and she calls Kosovo the most pro-American and pro-NATO country in the world. A Reuters article on this explains that Serbia and its traditional ally Russia do not recognize Kosovo's independence, and Moscow has blocked the country's bid to become a member of the United Nations. Belgrade considers Kosovo part of its territory, although it has no state institutions in its former breakaway province. The article also notes there are currently 3,770 NATO troops in Kosovo, of whom 600 are from the United States. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. Internal Revenue Service Commissioner Charles Rettig writes USA Today assured lawmakers Thursday that the agency will eliminate a backlog of more than 20 million unprocessed tax returns by the end of the year. IRS officials blame the backlog on several factors. Deep budget cuts that started around 2010 and continued over the following decade have drained the agency of the resources and the staffing it needs to enforce the nation's tax laws. At the same time, the agency has been tasked with implementing multiple revisions to the tax code in the past 2 years alone, processing three rounds of stimulus checks. Question to the commissioner at today's hearing by Congresswoman Judy Chu, Democrat from California. It was a Ways and Means Committee.
The IRS has announced the use of surge teams to address the tens of millions of returns in the backlog. In a sentence or two, can you tell me when will the backlog be eliminated? Before December?
My term ends in November, absolutely before December. And with all due respect, I would just add that my clock up here showed that I had a minute four. I didn't mean for you to have to gavel. I was watching my clock. But yes, we have 800 members of a surge team, which are experienced IRS employees who've come on to accounts management. We have 700 coming into submission processing. As of today, barring any unforeseen circumstances, COVID, et cetera, but if the world stays as it is today, we will be what we call healthy by the end of calendar year 22 and enter the 23 filing season with normal inventories, healthy as through the eyes of the taxpayer.
Thank you. That is very, very encouraging news to hear that definitive statement that the backlog will be cleared.
Congressman Tom Reed, Republican from New York, a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, which heard testimony today from the IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig, and he joins us now with more. Thanks for doing this. The commissioner promising today that the backlog of tax returns, tens of millions, will be caught up by the end of the year. Does that seem doable?
I hope so. And I wish the commissioner well, and we're going to hold him accountable to that time frame, because you know, these are real people behind each one of these cases. These are people that are frustrated. And one of the most intimidating and stressful things to have to deal with is the IRS. And so glad to hear the commissioner saying he's going to resolve this issue, and let's hope he gets it done.
What is the best way to get that done?
You know, I hope that we can put COVID and all of the issues that caused people to not be able to be in the office, be able to use technology to the extent possible. It's about having a strategy. It's about holding accountable the offices and the employees and just say, hey, this is what we have. This is what we got to do. Let's methodically and adopt a strategy to get it taken care of for the American people that are caught in this mess of the IRS backlog.
Does it require more funding?
You know, I've always heard this question about funding. And before we really go down the path of more funding, I would say, you know, let's hold you accountable to the existing funding that you have. I don't believe, in my humble opinion, that funding is the solution to this problem. There's unprecedented amounts of dollars that have been allocated to the IRS over years. And I think what this is more about is getting people back to work, getting them into the position of being in a spot to answer the phone call, be there to respond, and use technology to make it more effective and efficient so that we can get these calls answered and this backlog out the door.
Some members of Congress, including there's a bipartisan proposal in the Senate to take the IRS funding stream out of the regular annual appropriations, removing the political aspect. What do you think of that?
That's a continuation of the easy position of Congress. You know, pass it over to the mandatory spending, get it out of the control of Congress, and have Congress do less and less in regards to its job. I don't agree with that. I think this should be a regular conversation with the agency, and that the agency should be able to deliver results. And if it doesn't, the only way you're going to hold them accountable is by the power of the purse, which is in the Constitution.
We're talking with Congressman Tom Reed. How often do you hear from constituents about the IRS, and what's the main issue that comes up?
Yeah, lately, obviously, we hear this is one of the top three agencies that we deal with, Immigration, Social Security, and IRS, and it fluctuates back and forth. But IRS right now is on the top of people's minds. People are waiting for cash there. And what we hear, the biggest frustration is the lack of ability to talk to a live person. Long hold times, not being able to actually get their question answered because there's no connection between a person and an employee at the IRS. And so it's just as fundamental of just connecting the resources with the people. And the other thing on top of that we often come into is the lack of clear direction, yes or no, when an inquiry is made to the IRS. There's a hesitancy, I think, to answer questions because people want to be held accountable to those positions. And so they leave people in kind of this no man's land. And that's one of the things we're proud of. We'll tell people if the answer is no, you know, they have a right to know that too. But we try to get them to yes. But if being left in no man's land with no direction is the worst position I think constituents can be in.
And a final question, the commissioner mentioned today this could be his final testimony because he's leaving later this year. What would you look for in an IRS commissioner replacement?
I would look at a commissioner that comes from the private sector, bring those accountable metrics, someone who's open to not just doing the business the way that it's doing, and then also creates a culture of customer service, a culture that is always focused on constituents, getting them an answer and resolving their concerns. And that would be what I'd be looking for in a commissioner, one who kind of sets the tone by talking the talk but not and walks the walk.
Congressman Tom Reed, Republican from New York, member of the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Wall Street today, the Dow up 417, NASDAQ up 178, S&P up 53. Labor Department says 214,000 workers filed for new unemployment benefits last week. That's down 15,000 from the week before. New jobless claims have held at pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels since the end of 2021. With just a couple of weeks ago that a bill to end forced arbitration in sexual assault and sexual harassment cases passed Congress and was signed into law by President Biden. It allows people to bring those cases directly to court. Today, the U.S. House passing a bill to extend that ban on forced arbitration to other disputes involving employment, consumer issues, antitrust, and civil rights. Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, chairs the Judiciary Committee, starting off the debate.
For millions of workers and consumers, the precondition, whether they know it or not, of obtaining a basic service or product, such as a bank account, a cell phone, a credit card, or even a job, is that they must sign a non-negotiable contract that includes a provision requiring all disputes to be resolved in private arbitration. These take-it-or-leave-it contracts, which were once clearly disfavored under the law, now seem to have been blessed by the Supreme Court as standard operating procedure in the corporate world. That means for millions of people, the ability to enforce consumer, labor, antitrust, and civil rights laws are subject to the whims of a private arbitrator, often selected by the companies themselves. These private arbitrators are not required to provide plaintiffs any of the fundamental protections guaranteed in the courts, and their further employment can depend on building a good reputation with the companies that hire them. Unsurprisingly, arbitration has become a virtual get-out-of-jail-free card many companies use to circumvent the basic rights of consumers and workers. The FAIR Act reverses this disastrous trend by prohibiting the enforcement of forced arbitration clauses in consumer, labor, antitrust, and civil rights disputes. Importantly, this legislation does not preclude both parties from agreeing to arbitrate a claim after a dispute arises. It does, however, prevent unsuspecting consumers and employees from being forced to give up their right to seek justice in court.
Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat, chair of the Judiciary Committee on the House floor. The bill is named the FAIR Act by its sponsor, FAIR standing for Forced Arbitration and Justice Repeal. Speaking in opposition to the bill, Congressman Dan Bishop, Republican from North Carolina.
Democrats propose that arbitration is bad for Americans, but it has been a fixture of our legal landscape for almost 100 years. They claim that arbitration is forced. Both of their claims are wrong. Arbitration has many benefits. It is more efficient and faster than going to court. The rules are not nearly as arcane. Injured parties get their relief sooner and they spend less money along the way. Plaintiffs in employment and consumer disputes, according to studies, actually win more in arbitration than they do in court. They get more money in arbitration. They win more often in arbitration. Democrats know that arbitration has plenty of benefits. How do you know this? Because in this very bill, Democrats have carved out their union friends from the mandates of this bill. In other words, if the bill becomes law, powerful unions and no one else can still use these valuable agreements vis-a-vis individuals. This carve-out also tells us that Democrats know there is no such thing as forced arbitration. Agreements that are truly forced are already illegal under existing law in every state in the country. People are no more forced to agree to an arbitration provision than they are to agree to any other provision of a contract. The bill instead bans private parties from knowingly and willingly agreeing on a process to resolve future disputes. It tells Americans, no matter how informed or sophisticated they may be, that they can't be trusted to manage their own relationships by agreeing in advance to the means of resolution to be used in the event of a dispute.
Congressman Dan Bishop, Republican, North Carolina, debating on the House floor. The House passed this bill by a vote of 229-209 to send it over to the Senate. The House vote was almost all party line. Democrats yes, Republicans no, except one Republican voted yes, Matt Gaetz of Florida. From the Sacramento Bee in California, Vic Fazio, a powerful congressman who represented the Sacramento area in Washington for 20 years and became known as a Democrat stalwart who could work with Republicans, has died. He was 79 years old, a former state assemblyman and Sacramento County Planning Commissioner. Fazio was a Democrat who represented West Sacramento and much of Yolo County in the House of Representatives, ascending into leadership roles that earned him the nickname Mr. Goodwrench. Well, on the U.S. House floor today in Washington, a tribute from someone who said that Vic Fazio was his best friend, the current House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Democrat from Maryland.
For 20 years, Vic Fazio was the voice of Sacramento and Yolo County in the Congress. One of Vic's lasting legacies was the designation of 3,700 acres protected wetlands in Yolo County. Perhaps, Madam Speaker, we can name that territory after Vic Fazio. He was effective because he reached across the aisle and worked closely with Republicans and, as I mentioned, Jerry Lewis. When the legislative appropriation bill came to the floor, we were all proud because it was not a partisan bill. It was a bill for the institution and for the people. So we remember a man of intellect, of integrity, and a warm and genial nature who was proud of his service, proud of the Congress, and proud of his colleagues. Madam Speaker, I would ask all of us to rise for a moment of silence to remember a great, great American and great member of this House, Vic Fazio.
Congressman Steny Hoyer on the House floor today. C-SPAN was there back in 1997 when Vic Fazio announced that he would not run for another term in Congress. He spoke in his district in Woodland, California.
The nature of this deeply divided district always put me at the point of conflict on many of the contentious issues of the day. In fact, a few years ago, the Washington Press Corps called me a heat-seeking missile because I managed to become embroiled in many of the most controversial issues trying to find common ground. That's been my goal in public service, to find solutions, to make government work, and to get things done. And so whether it's been putting an end to the epidemic of methamphetamine or fighting for the water needs of the growers in Sacramento Valley or creating, as we did this weekend, more wetlands for the people and the wildlife of our region, or pushing, as we did later in this term, for an innovative way to fund breast cancer research, I think we can all agree that we have accomplished much of which to be proud.
Former Congressman Vic Fazio, Democrat from California, announcing that he wouldn't run again. That was back in 1997, and it's from C-SPAN's video library. At the time, he was the House Democratic Caucus Chair. Vic Fazio has passed away at the age of 79. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories sent to your inbox each day by signing up to get C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.